What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And filling in for Adam this week, I'm Angelica Jade Bastien.
This is Katana. She's got my back. She can cut all you in half with one sword stroke, just like mowing the lawn. I would advise not getting killed by her. Her sword traps the souls of its victims.
When I bring in a new co-host, I do not mess around. Angelica, how exactly does your sword trap the souls of its victims?
Just have to keep it sharp.
Good to know. Angelica and I review the supervillains run amok movie, Suicide Squad, and share our top five woman comic book characters done right. That and more.
Criticize our review at your own peril.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including Philip in Seattle, Ted in Raleigh, North Carolina, and Keith Geiger in Ocean City, Maryland. Keith, a silver-level donor, sent this note. Just wanted to say thanks again for inspiring me to hold another film camp this summer. We had the second annual I've Seen That film camp at the school where I teach. Last year we did genres. This year, we focused on directors. Here was the rundown. Monday was Citizen Kane and Touch of Evil. Tuesday, Vertigo and Psycho. Wednesday, Jaws and Close Encounters. Thursday, Punch Drunk Love and There Will Be Blood. Friday, Rushmore and Moonrise Kingdom. We had a great time watching, discussing, arguing, and bonding over some great films. I certainly wouldn't have the confidence in instructing the camp if it wasn't for the years listening to Film Spotting. To be honest, I still don't feel very qualified, but I tried my best. It was a big success. Thank you again, and I hope you continue to bring happiness and inspiration for another 600 episodes. Keith's first email to us was actually July 2007, so he's been listening for at least 9 years. Keith, we hope you stick around for the next 600. We also wanted to thank new gold-level donor Alex. He's from Cranford, New Jersey. Adam, Josh, Sam, it's wonderful to see you counting down to your 600th episode. I also have some good news. My wife, Cara Consilvio, wrote and directed a short film that will premiere at the Live Free or Die Film Festival in Manchester, New Hampshire on August 12th, and it has also been selected for the New Jersey Film Festival in October. The name of the film is CIT. It stars Emily Vera Nicole from Experimenter. I executive produced and storyboarded the film. Good luck with that, Alex and Kara, and thanks to you, thanks to Keith, Ted, Philip, and to all our regular monthly donors. Of course, there is a no-cost way that you can help the show. Just rate or review us on iTunes. Since we've been making this request the last several weeks, we have had more visibility, so it seems to be helping. Do keep those reviews coming. Thanks to Film Spotter, KJ He, Jello X Shot Eclectic Ange, and Gabriel 2494, who posted quick reviews over the past week. My guest host this week, Chicago-based critic Angelica Jade Bastien. Angelica, thank you so much for saying yes to the invitation we extended. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I know some listeners will be familiar with you because you've had a very busy year of working. I first came across your work, I think it might have been around February, when you did the Keanu Reeves essay. That was for Bright Wall, Dark Room. I imagine you got a pretty big response to that essay. It seems like that got passed around a fair amount and people were talking about it.
Yes, it did. I'm still waiting for Keanu to actually call me up.
So the most important person has not responded to that one.
He hasn't, but he will.
Well, eventually, I'm sure it'll happen. You've also written for Vulture, The Atlantic, many other places, and you have superior knowledge, I would say, of the subjects that will be covered on this week's show. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with comic books and maybe their movie adaptations as well.
Well, I've been seriously reading comic books since I was 9 years old and spending far, far too much money on them and becoming far too obsessive with their adaptations as well.
Sounds perfect. You're the expert we need. Our top five this week, women comic book characters done right, and maybe one that's done very, very wrong, but you'll have to be listening very closely for that one. First, though, Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn is a woman and a comic book character, but is she and her movie, Suicide Squad, done right?
I want to build a team of some very bad people who I think can do some good.
Y'all jokers must be crazy. I'm not just one of y'all many toys.
the deal. You disobey me, you die. Try to escape, you die.
You got a boyfriend?
You irritate or vex me.
I'm known to be quite vexing. I'm just forewarning you.
You die.
If they get caught, we throw them under the bus.
What a ride!
Angelica, we've just come from the Chicago press screening of Suicide Squad right into the studio. So this is going to be one of those first impression reviews we sometimes do on the show. Not much of a sophisticated setup for you here, then. Some basic details we should get out of the way first. Suicide Squad is an adaptation of the DC comic about a government agency that recruits a band of imprisoned supervillains to conduct high-risk missions in exchange for more lenient sentencing. The director is David Ayer, and the cast is particularly interesting. Will Smith as Deadshot, Jared Leto as the Joker, and Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn. So sitting here now, Angelica, with fresh visions of demonic enchantresses and Joker grills dancing in your head, what's your initial take on Suicide Squad?
I have a lot of mixed feelings about the film.
Okay, let's get into it.
I think that David Ayer and DC Comics and the powers that be behind the film do not trust the general audience to just kind of buy into the world. And it felt like they kept stopping to give us a bit more backstory just as the momentum was picking up. So it left the film feeling very oddly structured. The pacing was terrible.
Yeah, there's almost a flashcard section at the beginning introducing most of these characters.
Yeah,
right?
Like here are these villains. This is what they're good at. And these are how many people they killed. And look, Captain Boomerang has a thing for pink unicorns.
I'm assuming that has a lot of significance for people familiar with the comic.
Who cares about Captain Boomerang? He's annoying in the comics. He's annoying in the film. He's always been messy. Never liked him.
And the impression to me is that they could have lost. I mean, obviously, you're not going to do that in a adaptation like this, but a lot of these characters felt extraneous to me as someone who...
Interesting.
I checked out a few issues of the comics, and I know it's gone different variations over different years, so I may not have looked at the one that this is directly based on. But I have some familiarity with it from that. But if you have none, a lot of this seems superfluous.
Interesting. I didn't even think of that. Just a word to people, though. This isn't actually based on any one Suicide Squad comic. This actual lineup has not existed in the comics, but they're
okay.
With DC Comics just has their new Rebirth line, and surprise, surprise, there's going to be a Suicide Squad comic with the film's lineup.
Got it.
So, like Harley Quinn is pretty, like she's really new to Suicide Squad, but characters like Deadshot, he's been in there for a while. Same with Captain Boomerang. They're very different from their comic incarnations in some very important ways. Like, Deadshot isn't black in the comics, so that's a nice change.
Okay.
Amanda Waller is obviously very important to Suicide Squad. So there are some... They're obviously taken from different parts of DC's history and having a bit of fun in terms of not being super beholden to the comics. But then at the same time, you can feel like a pressure. Like, it's as if they're afraid to just... embrace the world they're in and just like really go for it.
It's strange to me that you point that out, which I didn't know, because it would seem that there's more freedom that Ayer and the filmmakers here would have if they're somewhat working from scratch and not beholden to a specific time frame in this comic's history.
Yeah.
Yet it does not feel like a free-flowing movie at all to me. It feels very much like the filmmakers were given a specific list of things they had to check off, and then they went ahead and met those in a very clumsy manner. I mean, for me, basically, my first impression, my takeaway is not good. I'm worse than mixed on it. And there are some formal reasons maybe we can get into about that. I think we should talk about the action and we should talk about the acting in some cases.
Yeah.
But overall, this helped me. Suicide Squad helped clarify something for me why a lot of these comic book adaptations don't work. And I think the movies are big enough for superhero characters and stories, but I don't know if they're wide enough. And by that, I mean when you look at these expansive cast films, so whether it's Avengers or X-Men or now Suicide Squad and the forthcoming Justice League, a lot of them have this mold that include expansive mythologies that are very dense, relationships that are very complicated. All of this sort of stuff requires time, the sort of time, say, a television series can give you. And maybe mm-hmm. that's why people are responding well to some of these Netflix superhero shows or other ones. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but sometimes you hear that they really are able to dig into the characters a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Suicide Squad, to me, does not do that at all and makes very clumsy attempts to do some of the backstory, then jettisons the motivations that you saw in that backstory, I would say for Harley Quinn in particular, the Margot Robbie character, mm-hmm. and in Will Smith's Deadshot. They do things that from the very little backstory we get and sense of motivation we get completely contradict that. And so this feels like a complete jumble to me.
See, I think just because I come from a background where I've read all the Suicide Squad comics. I know these. I know DC characters very, very, very well. Probably a little too well. I'm probably a little too obsessed.
Okay.
So I didn't feel that way. But I, of course, have a whole knowledge of the relationship between these characters, and I understand what they're pulling from in a way that I feel general audiences won't, which is going to work against the film. I kind of wish they would have done a smaller cast.
Yes, that would have helped a lot, I think.
They did not need Katana, who's never been in Suicide Squad. So I was like, why did they decide? And she's a character I like. But I was like, why did they decide to bring her in? One. Two, why is she only speaking Japanese? But she knows English because we see her randomly speak English, which is a very weird stereotype to deal with that made me very uncomfortable. And she's actually a character with a very rich and interesting history. And I felt they really didn't do her justice. And it was very infuriating because
she's completely inexplicable here.
She could have been completely taken out and it would have been fine and wouldn't have given room for the other character. They should have just knocked out several characters, including Enchantress's brother, which comes out of nowhere.
Enchantress, we should say, becomes the supervillain to these villains, kind of like, and there are so many layers here. That's part of the problem. And yes, she's at one point, one incarnation of her, who is a very interesting character because she's been possessed by this Enchantress. Mm-hmm. And so she's sort of on the team, but then Enchantress, who's the demonic witch, takes over and becomes the supervillain. And yes, somehow also they feel like she needs a brother to complicate things further.
I feel like they could have, and I did not like the character design of the brother at all. I felt like it was from a completely different film and it didn't really work within the world of the
story. It's all CGI.
Yeah, and it doesn't look good compared to everything else. Like they made such great effort, like with Killer Croc. I recently read David Ayer was considering using King Shark, which is actually a character who actually pops up in the Suicide Squad comics, and he's basically a dude who used to be human and is now a really huge shark who sometimes wears pants. And he popped up in season 2 of The Flash, completely CGI. And they knew that that wouldn't really work as a main team member. So they're like, let's do Killer Croc. It still gives us the animalistic dude.
And it's a flesh and blood figure on film you can see.
And it's more interesting to look at. And so it seems like they went through great pains to really like build this world and make it feel real. And then here comes Enchantress's brother, who's Enchantress is very weirdly adapted to the screen also. And I'm not one of those comic fans who's really obsessed with them sticking to the letter, especially because there's so many versions of these characters. So, you know, what version are you really going to adapt? But Enchantress, how they adapted her is very strange, especially because she wears much less clothing in the movie than she does in the comics.
Okay, that's going to get to a significant topic for our top five list, I think. But let's get into it here. One more thing I want to point out about Enchantress, and it ties in with the CGI, is you'll notice there are times where she's in full power and she's almost entirely CGI. And we start to lose that tactile nature and she becomes just this, you know, kind of ghosty figure. But she also, when she loses her powers, the movie drops all that and she becomes this really interestingly, like kind of muddy, dirty, tendrily figure. But it's a real actress, right? And suddenly that one character shows you the folly of certain CGI because as soon as she loses all of those CGI powers, she becomes real and so much more of a figure that the characters have to deal with and interact with. Yes, she's pretty flimsily dressed for a demonic witch. I don't know if that's the standard costume.
No, it's not, which is kind of hilarious because you're used to seeing it be the opposite where they're put on film and somehow they have, you know, I'm very surprised with how little clothing she's wearing. Actually, the design for Enchantress when she's not totally CGI actually looks really cool and is not from the comics. Just the kind of, it seems like embers are kind of falling around her and the glowing eyes. That actually looks really, really cool. And how she transforms and you see the hand.
Best shot in the film is when the woman who Enchantress possesses, played by Cara Delevingne, her name is June Moon, the character's name, she's looking like herself, and suddenly we see her hand is on a desk, and up from under her hand comes black fingers that represent Enchantress's, and they intertwine with June's human hand and suddenly flip around, and with that, she becomes possessed. That is also uses CGI, so I'm not entirely criticizing the use of CGI here, but a wonderful way to make it interweave with a real human element. And it was incredibly creepy and effective, and I thought that really worked. Now, we've gone a little bit off topic from the costuming, because I want to ask you this in relation to Harley Quinn, because you had said when we were hanging out earlier this summer how this was one character you were really intrigued about how they were going to handle her, and we're doing our top five, which is female comic book characters done right. How did you feel about the characterization of her?
So let me preface my opinion by saying one thing I was very, very worried about coming into this movie was the domestic violence angle that is completely dominates her relationship with the Joker. It always has. So when she debuted in Batman the Animated Series in 1992, she was really like a force of nature and very fascinating and a completely different energy than any of the other villains. But a major part of her story is that she's pretty much in an abusive relationship with the Joker. And so going into this movie, I knew they're either going to have to really reckon with that and be honest with the fact that it's a really messed up relationship, or they're going to have to take all that out and how that actually affect her character, because a major part of her arc in the comics is her kind of becoming her own woman and getting out of this very violent relationship, and she ends up becoming Poison Ivy's girlfriend and like just being her own badass villain. So in the movie,
not what we get.
In the movie, it's weird because she's very codependent, and it actually really bothered me that they were playing up as just a love, like a really twisted love story. Like they're the Bonnie and Clyde of Gotham. That could be interesting, except for the fact that you remember she used to be his psychiatrist and he's pretty much manipulated her out of whatever life she's ever known.
Exactly.
It's they try to have their cake and eat it too with it in a way that I find very uncomfortable.
What do we have here?
What are you gonna do? Are you gonna kill me, Mr. J?
What? Oh, I'm not gonna kill you. I'm just gonna hurt you really, really bad.
Knowing what you just told me about the background of the character is so much more compelling than what is presented on the screen, because you're right, they go romantic with it mostly, or they go funny. That's the two qualities that they bring to it. And the fact that she was Joker's psychiatrist is sometimes completely forgotten.
Completely.
What I don't understand.
She's also way too young to be such.
Well, there's that,
don't
of
even
course.
Get me
but, but what I don't understand, and there's almost two scenes here, transformation scenes, where the Joker tortures her and she essentially turns into Harley Quinn. And then later on, we get a flashback where he convinces her to jump into a vat of acid. And this shows you how incongruous the narrative alone of this film is, because I didn't know which was, had they forgotten that this had already happened to her in a different way. But basically, you never know who she is as a person, who she was really before, and how she became who she is now. And one element is even that she talks differently afterwards. She has like a Jersey Girl act. When we see her as a psychiatrist, she doesn't have that.
Yeah.
She's playing up and using her sexuality as a weapon. So she's a very sexual character. But again, where does the motivation for that come from? Because when we see her as a psychiatrist, there's no hint of that. So did the Joker just imbue that in her? It's I thought this was going to be a very intriguing character, and Margot Robbie is very talented and working very hard here to sell some good lines that are inexplicably jumped over by bad editing.
Yeah.
But the character overall never has a solid foundation for us to follow her from.
So one thing I thought about, and again, this is because of my background, I thought that they were almost playing with the idea that she doesn't even know who she really is and that her memories aren't to really be trusted. but they don't play up enough who she was before, and maybe seeing like, oh, so did he like torture her? And now she's sort of bought into this narrative. Plus he puts her into the Acme vat that caused his transformation. And so now that's why her mind is so warped. Like, that actually could be a really interesting narrative to see. And then maybe just her becoming her own person.
If they had picked one of those roads to go down. And seem to try to go for both.
They really try to go for both. But I do really like, she's having a lot of fun and I enjoyed watching her. It'll be interesting because Margot Robbie fell in love with the character so much and started reading DC Comics that she decided to hire her own screenwriter and bring an idea to DC and Warner Brothers to do a movie that has Harley, but actually features a lot of other female heroes and villains. So a lot of us are thinking it's Birds of Prey. I'm praying it's Birds of Prey, or maybe Gotham City Sirens. But the movie Suicide Squad has not earned that.
No, I mean, if they are going to do that, they're going to have to completely reboot this character. Because as is, for me, she makes no sense. Jared Leto, people are probably going to be curious about, what did you make of that performance?
Jared.
Isn't sounding good.
Yeah, I will cut him some slack. The Joker is a very daunting character to pull off.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, first of all, he's coming on the heels of Heath Ledger, who won an Oscar for his performance and did an amazing job creating his own Joker. And the Joker is the most iconic, probably one of the most iconic DC villains. So there's a lot of weight on his shoulders, especially with also just how his career is going.
But
I really wanted to jump into the movie and say, can you please enunciate? Because I do not understand what you're saying about 60% of the time.
Yeah, he does this growl. It's like a low growl often. And he's speaking quickly. He's repeating things. Honestly, it is brave of him to take on the part. I agree. It was brave of Heath Ledger to take it on after Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
What I would do, though, I think, is something as far away from Heath Ledger as possible, which is what Ledger did compared to Nicholson.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of Heath Ledger in this performance, I think. I was surprised by that. To me, it was a combination of maybe 60% Heath Ledger's Joker and 40% James Franco's Alien in Spring Breakers. Did you see Spring Breakers?
Oh, my God. Oh, that's a good point.
With the grills. And and he has sort of, he's wearing chains a lot.
And
the physicality.
Yeah.
And that combination, I don't know if that was a direct influence or not, but it's certainly on the screen for me, just made this an unoriginal performance that is trying so hard to be weird. Just trying so hard to be weird and never quite embodying it.
Yeah, he's trying way too hard. And I think, so I'm going to get a little comic booky here. I think there's this obsession with the Joker as chaos personified, and it would be really smart for the movies to go in the exact opposite direction and make him more of the clown prince of crime. Like, that would be far more interesting and be very different than any villain we're seeing in any comic book movie, where he's actually super smart and that's why he's always surviving these crazy things. He's obviously has to be smart. How does he get out of all these things? But he just seems like a thug with a lot of style.
Exactly. Yeah, that's my impression too. So some of the other problems I had, I should probably get to some other positives besides that one shot. But let me get a few other things off my chest. First has to do with the action, which, you know, I think of Ayers films, the ones I mentioned at the top here. A lot of gunfire, right?
Too much gunfire.
This, I mean, you have a superhero movie, super villain movie, where some of them have powers. And we see that on occasion.
Yeah.
But man, is this a lot of shooting, a lot of machine guns.
Too much shooting.
And it was just, it's just deadening.
Yeah.
I mean, it wore me down.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was just a strange choice to make. And when we did get some fight scenes, one takes place in a smoky setting where you can hardly tell what's going on.
That was infuriating. That was really, really, that final fight with everybody was really infuriating because it really should have played up their different physicalities, because you get a little bit of that with Harley Quinn and how acrobatic she is, but they forget about it to do another shot of her butt.
There's a little bit of that. You're right. Okay, so one other good thing I do want to say is I think Viola Davis
is
is really good as Amanda Waller, who is essentially the mastermind behind this group. It's her idea to get them together, and she holds the power. She has this device. They have things implanted in their necks, and she has this device where essentially she can blow them up at any time if they don't do what she says. And the movie at the beginning is really interesting in terms of positioning her as this authoritarian figure who you don't know what to make of, right? Mm-hmm. Ostensibly, she's doing this in service of protecting the United States. Mm-hmm. But really, she's manipulating these people, some of whom are maybe less villainous than others.
Yeah,
we could just say some of them are just, you know, being demonized, essentially.
Yeah.
Viola Davis plays this straight, deadpan, and I thought it was a really strong performance. That was a character from the few issues of the Suicide Squad comic I read that really jumped out at me as someone who was interesting. So I'm glad, to me, you know, if I had to pick a woman comic book character done right, I think she's the one from this film.
Yeah, she's definitely on my list. I want to praise Amanda Waller. She is, in the comics, a dark-skinned, overweight black woman who's a widow from Chicago who can intimidate Batman. She has no superpower. She's just incredibly smart. She's witty. You do not mess with the wall.
There you go. Call.
But without you minding her, your lady friend stays here strapped to a board in a drug-induced coma.
They warned me about you. My dumbass didn't believe the stories.
Nobody does.
And you can see that she respects the character, but she's bringing a little bit of herself into it. And there are, in terms of Amanda Waller, there have been other times she's been on screen. She was played by Pam Grier in Smallville. Then there was how she's been adapted in Arrow, which I like to call Walmart Batman, since they take so many Batman storylines.
Okay.
But this version of Amanda Waller is just, it's unlike anything I think DC has done in the films, and I appreciate them just letting her be someone who's truly an anti-hero. I feel that term gets, you know, banded around every time a white guy kills somebody off and then has a quip he says afterwards, but Amanda Waller is a true anti-hero. She truly believes what she's doing is for the good of the country, and what she's doing is vicious. I mean, she killed off
and
all...
And messed up.
It's messed up. And she doesn't blink. It's just, oh, I just love Amanda Waller.
Well, I'm glad I found something that I did like about Suicide Squad and that you do agree. Suicide Squad opens in wide release this weekend. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net.
Mustard. Oh, sausages and buns.
From the people who brought you Superbad and Thomas and Friends Big Bang Surprise, it's Sausage Party. Bit of the trailer there for the raunchy new animated comedy from Seth Rogen, Jonah Hill, and friends. And yes, seriously, it's co-directed by a guy whose previous credit is Thomas and Friends First Class Stories. Sausage Party is opening wide next weekend, and it's one of the films that's being considered for a review on next week's show when Adam and a co-host, to be named later, will be running things. Now, Angelica, admit it, if I had invited you to review Sausage Party on this show, you wouldn't be here, would you?
I would have laughed in your face if you actually did that.
I guess that. Well, Adam from the sunny beaches of Puerto Rico posted a Twitter poll asking which film should be reviewed next week, whether it should be Sausage Party, Hell or High Water. This is from startup director David McKenzie. It's a family crime drama with Jeff Bridges, Ben Foster, and Chris Pine. Or Pete's Dragon, the live-action remake of the 70s animated film directed by Ain't Them Body Saints' David Lowry. You can see the results of the poll, which Adam would want me to note is not binding, especially the way it seemed to be going, by following Adam on Twitter at FilmSpotting. Maybe that should have been the poll question we posted on last week's show, which is also Sausage Party related. We went with a raunchy animated comedy deathmatch, South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut versus Team America World Police. Given that Adam and I thought this might be a landslide win for Team America, the results so far are a little surprising, but the bigger takeaway might be that most listeners couldn't seem to care less about either of these films. So far, this is one of the lowest entered polls in recent memory. Loser, in any case, will be Matt Stone and Trey Parker. Angelica, are you equally disinterested in this poll, or do you have strong feelings about one of those movies over the other?
I have no strong feelings about either of these films. I forgot about their very existence until this moment.
That's what we're here for. We love giving out passes whenever we can to advance screenings for listeners, and we have some for an upcoming showing of Kubo and the Two Strings. This is the epic animated fantasy from Laika Animation Studios. They did Box Trolls, Paranorman, and Coraline. The movie opens August 19. Our passes are good for an advanced screening on Tuesday, August 9. It's going to be at Chicago's Showplace Icon Theater. If you want a chance to win those, visit filmspotting.net, and you'll see how to enter at the top of our page there. Okay, time now for Massacre Theater. It's the part of the show where we perform a scene, and you get a chance at winning a prize. A couple weeks back, Adam and I massacred this scene.
1 minute. I'm on the 14th hole at Wingfoot, lining up a putt. A heart attack later, I'm a worm feast.
No, 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 no. You're not a worm feast. You're a hallucination brought on by alcohol, Russian vodka poisoned by Chernobyl. I've been under a lot of pressure lately. I've been putting on a big...
Silence! Ugh. Out.
I had it all.
Ooh. I was a captain of industry. Feared by men, adored by women.
Adored? Let's be honest, Lou. You paid for the women.
I'm warning you.
Bill Murray as Frank Cross and John Forsythe as the rotting corpse of Lou Hayward in 1988's Scrooged, written by Mitch Glazer and Michael O'Donohue. They got a little help from the ghost of Christmas Past, Charles Dickens. It was directed, I did not realize this, by Richard Donner. That massacre was part of a show Adam and I did a couple weeks back, where we also shared Adam's interview with James Solomon, the director of the new documentary, The Witness. We reviewed the new Ghostbusters on that show as well, hence the Bill Murray scene. A few listeners wrote in with some suggestions of their own, including Eden Palmer from Minneapolis.
This week's Massacre Theater was Scrooge, which relates to Ghostbusters both in the appearance of Bill Murray. My God, what a performance, Josh.
Thank you.
I thought we might be listening to the goofy movie. Oh, is that an insult?
They always insult me.
Okay, let me start over. I was like, wait a minute. that really threw me off.
Wow. I know, it's hard to believe, goofy especially movie. When we do Massacre Theater and you see how good I am. It's hard to believe people would insult me, but go ahead. Okay. I can take it.
Okay. As well as its existence as a rehash, reheat, remake, or whatever you want to call it, of A Christmas Carol. Scrooged is a Christmas favorite of mine. My first and favorite job in high school was at a small-town movie theater. On holidays, we would string up lights and seasonal displays, and our manager would hold themed movie marathons for all the employees. So despite being born nearly a decade after its release, I got to watch Scrooged on the big screen 3 years in a row. I have to say, I was not looking forward to it prior to the screening, having never really cared for the story of A Christmas Carol in the first place. But Murray and cast are ridiculous and funny throughout, perhaps unlike the new Ghostbusters, or maybe it's just the nostalgia that has me watching it years later.
We also heard from Michelle, who's in Tulsa. I love it. The most obvious tie-ins are Bill Murray, who was in Ghostbusters, and all the ghosts. But how about the unintended tie-ins, like Christmas in July, and the fact that Dickens' A Christmas Carol may possibly be the most remade, rebooted movie of all time, making a single reboot of Ghostbusters seem like child's play. All right, Angelica, help me pick out a winner here among those listeners who guessed correctly. Reach into the film spotting hat, and who have you got?
Ed Killingsworth from Huntsville, Alabama.
Congratulations, Ed. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your prize.
What do I know? I'm lucky to get the part. I know that. I come from Chicago. We do things a little differently out there. We do the play as written. That doesn't go over in New York. Terrific.
So, Angelica, I understand you've seen this movie, but you haven't seen it in a long time. You didn't watch this scene in preparation, so you're just going to wing this and see how it comes out, right?
I'm going for it.
All right. Well, there are no rules in Massacre Theater, so that'll be just fine. I want to remind people, as far as my part goes, that intentionally bad acting is really hard to do. So give me a little leeway here, and if you think I'm awful, that's on purpose.
Yeah, my bad acting isn't intentional. It's just coming naturally.
So. Well, that's fine, too. All right. So let's see here. You are going to start us off, so I'm going to give you the action if you're ready to go.
I'm ready.
And action.
CJ, it's a pleasure to see you. You're looking rather buoyant this evening.
Shut up. My fee.
$10,000?
No. The price went up for this one, Tommy.
We had an agreement.
You told me Rock was alone and unarmed. He wasn't.
Now, how could I know that? Bounty hunting is an ugly, unpredictable business. CJ, you of all people should know that. How much?
20,000 Canadian. And scene.
And we should note there, Canadian is another clue. So I'm just going to give you guys that because this, I don't know how many people actually saw this movie, so it might be sort of a difficult one. If you do know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback at filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, August 15th. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Alpha Team report.
What's happening, Heather?
Alpha Team isn't responding.
Bravo?
Still nothing.
You lost both teams? Get a grip on this operation, Heather. That's bored. Greenlight the asset.
Sir, I need more time.
We have no time. Are you going to give that order or not?
Tommy Lee Jones and Alicia Vikander there in that scene from Jason Bourne. The fourth film in that series? Fifth?
Well,
see, I got myself into trouble last time not knowing how many Ice Age movies there were. There's the one without Renner. So anyways, it's another one. This has Matt Damon reuniting with signature series director Paul Greengrass. Angelica, do you have any attachment to the Bourne franchise at all? Have you seen some of them, none of them?
I've seen the original trilogy, but because I love myself, I haven't watched it in years. And I don't really care for it. And I think it's far too esteemed in the critical community.
Well, okay then. Well, I like them quite a bit. Let me say that. This movie, though, people seem to be swinging your way. Mm-hmm. Generally not very favorable reviews. I'll say it's better than that. I did catch up with it over the weekend because I do like the series. My wife, Debbie, as I've mentioned on the show, is a big fan. Yeah. Not quite enough punching Matt Damon for her, even though he has some boxing scenes. And she's right. It does give into this elaborate car chase at the end that doesn't make use of him at all. So I can see that point. But for me, there were two signature surveillance sequences in this movie that make it worth checking out, I would say. And this is where Paul Greengrass does what he does best. I know if you don't like his shaky cam style, you know, you're not going to, this isn't going to win you over. But he's good at it. Let's just say that. He knows how to make it work along with the editing. And there is a scene, a game of cat and mouse during a riot in Athens where Damon is running around and people, of course, are after him. And essentially Greengrass has raised the bar of difficulty by creating all this chaos around him. Mm. Yet still, through the editing and the camera work, makes us always know what's going on. And that, for me, is just really rewarding to watch. Then there's another sequence set in London
that has a lot. I want to go back and study this one because to me it has a lot of implications for the overall meta idea of audience and what it means to watch. There's this intricately staged meetup sequence in which Bourne is basically running one con. And then there are these various CIA agents on the site who are not only trying to thwart him, but attempting to undermine each other at the same time. Now, us as an audience, we're watching this and it's narrated via various channels of communication, both audio and visual. And so, you know, Bourne is watching one target, others are watching him, still others are watching those watchers, and then we're watching them all. And again, it's this choreography of editing and sound that's really masterful. I mean, it's in the middle of an okay spy movie whose narrative makes no sense. Mm-hmm. They try to become timely by interweaving something with personal privacy on the internet and government surveillance that doesn't fit in there at all. But hey, for those two sequences, I would say it's worth checking out.
Maybe David Ayer could study those sequences and learn what good editing looks like.
There is a vast difference between the editing in Jason Bourne and in Suicide Squad. I will give you that. Jason Bourne is currently playing in wide release. Let me know what you thought. Feedback at filmspotting.net is the best way to do that.
You never met a man before? I mean, what about your father?
I had no father. I was brought to life by Zeus.
Well, that's neat.
That is some of the trailer for one of 2017's most anticipated films, Wonder Woman. It's one of the most iconic characters in the history of comics. She's finally getting a film of her own. And based on that trailer, I'd say it looks pretty good. Gal Gadot reprising her role. And one interesting thing about Wonder Woman is that it's directed by a woman as well, Patty Jenkins, best known as director of Monster, which earned Charlize Theron her Oscar. I think that's a good place, Angelica, to start our conversation for this week's top five, women comic book characters done right. I'm assuming you've had a chance to see the Wonder Woman trailer.
I've seen it over 50 times.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Because
I love Wonder Woman. I have a Wonder Woman shower curtain, a Wonder Woman keychain, Wonder Woman pajamas, a Wonder Woman mug.
Wonder Woman shower head? They make Star Wars shower heads.
No, a shower curtain.
I know, but well, why don't you get the shower head? Come on, you're not a true fan.
I mean, I don't want to like intimidate the men who come over and think that I'm actually some crazy. Well, actually, you know what? I am kind of a crazy Amazon. That would work.
Because the shower curtain would not intimidate them, but the shower head might put it over
They'd
the top.
They'd be like, oh, wow. Okay, she's obsessed.
I get it. All right, that makes sense. So does the trailer look promising to you?
Too
early to tell.
It's really too early to tell. I do like how it looks a little bit different from the other DC films, and she has a glowing lasso, and there's women talking to each other. Wow, I didn't know
ingenious
comic movies could do that.
Well, hopefully there will be a lot of that in the finished film. We'll find out. And maybe retroactively, we'll be able to put Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman on the list like the one we're talking about here, top five women comic book characters done right. We should point out that for this top five, we are going to allow graphic novels. Just think it's aesthetically consistent with comic books and also allows us to broaden the range of characters we could consider. So let's jump right into it then, Angelica. Who is your number five female comic book character done right?
So I'm picking a controversial choice. I'm choosing for number five, Feyora from Man of Steel. Yes, that Man of Steel.
The much derided Man
yes,
of Steel
yes.
that very few people like. Okay.
Yes, Feyora from that Man of Steel, where the best thing that Zack Snyder did in probably the course of his career was to decide to have Henry Cavill shirtless as frequently as possible and have a little bit of the chest hair coming out from his Superman suit. Thank you, Zack Snyder.
How many meetings do you think they had to determine just how much chest hair to show?
You know, honestly, I think they probably would have, because it is a very interesting choice. Like, I'm not used to seeing that. And I was like, wow, this Superman is a man. But we're not talking about
him. I was just going to say, you remember this list is supposed to be about women characters.
I started thinking about his body.
On track, Angelica.
Sorry. So Feyora from Man of Steel, she's really fascinating character. And I think for an actress to be able to stand on her own next to Michael Shannon chewing through the scenery.
He did.
And yeah, he did. I felt like he was possessed by the ghost of Bette Davis and was just destroying Metropolis.
I think I would have liked Man of Steel a little bit better if I'd thought about it that way.
Well, see, that's the thing. Maybe because I tend to watch Man of Steel when I've been drinking a lot, that my opinion of the movie is a little different.
Okay. You just undermined your number five pick, but go ahead.
But even when sober, I still like Feyora.
All right.
Her physicality is really fascinating. She has a fun little sense of humor. She's snarky. She totally beat up Superman, so she was fun to watch. And the actress had a very different energy than anybody else in the film.
The actress whose name you're not saying because you're going to leave it to me to butcher, right? Okay, I'm going to try this. Antje Traue. A-N-T-J-E-T-R-A-U-E.
You are weak, son of El. Unsure of yourself. The fact that you possess a sense of morality and we do not gives us an evolutionary advantage. And if history has proven anything, it is that evolution always wins.
And she's somewhat playing the character of Ursa from Superman 2, who was played by Sarah Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
Next to Zod, I remember as a kid thinking all three of those villains were great, but her in particular, you prefer this performance to Sarah Douglas's, though.
Yes, I do. I'm going to piss some people off. I'm not that big of a fan of those Superman films.
Any of them, really?
I enjoy them, but Superman as a character, I feel like I've never... Either the performance will be nailed, but not everything else around it. So he seems to be a character I think that's hard to pull off and adapt.
Okay, fair enough. My number five, I'm going to go with a pick from Scott Pilgrim versus the World, Edgar Wright's adaptation of Brian Lee O'Malley's graphic novel about a 20-something Toronto bassist, played by Michael Cera, who's oblivious to most things in life outside of his band and the girl he's recently fallen for. That would be a visiting American named Ramona Flowers. She's played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead. So I rewatched this, as I mentioned on last show, thinking Ramona was probably going to be my pick for this list. I love Winstead's drop-dead attitude. She has some really well-timed touches of vulnerability. She's just much more interesting than your usual romantic object of desire. But you know who is much more fun than I remembered?
Who?
Ellen Wong. As Knives' child.
Nice.
Scott's high school girlfriend, who he abruptly dumps to pursue Ramona. I'd forgotten that the movie, though it starts with her as this clingy joke, really lets her stick around, even after Scott and Ramona become a couple. And I loved how Wong manages to give her a character arc of maturation, even though she doesn't have that many scenes to work with, but she still pulls it off. You sort of want to get away from Knives at the start, like Scott does, but by the end, he comes off as sort of a chump, and she's really smart and endearing. So I get it if others will go with Ramona for a list like this. I'm going to go with Knives Chow as my number five.
Knives? That's priceless.
You'll pay for what you did to him.
Listen, Kung Pao Chicken. Your old, old boyfriend brought this all on himself. He was warned plenty of times, but did he listen? No.
I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to her!
What?
You broke the heart that broke mine. Get ready to tear down!
Number four, Angelica. Who'd you have in that spot?
So I'm cheating. Sorry. I'm choosing Andrea Beaumont, also known as Phantasm from the Batman animated film Mask of Phantasm.
So this is cheating because
she's not actually a comic character. She was created for the film and then she's popped up afterwards in comics, but she's primarily a character who's known for her appearances in the animated universe.
So similar to Harley Quinn's character.
Yeah, but Harley Quinn has now has a far more in-depth history in the comics.
Okay.
Like, Andrea's popped up in very few comics.
All right. So why is she on this list?
I love the voice work by Dana Delaney. It is on point.
So what does that mean to you? Because some people look for different things in vocal performances, and what makes one stand out in your mind?
So what I like about her vocal performance is it very much suits the world of Batman the Animated Series and the film, which has a very Art Deco 30s vibe, and I feel like she could have walked off the set of His Girl Friday.
Hey, what happened to you? Trip over some loose cash? It's been 3 days since we met and still no calls. I figured you must be dead or something.
You expect every guy you meet to call you up?
The ones that are smart enough to dial a phone. What is that?
Jiu-jitsu.
Gesundheit. That was a joke.
Jiu-jitsu is no joke. It takes years to master. Hey!
Got a few moves of my own.
I did watch this again because it's only an hour and 15 minutes, so that helped. And I remember seeing it when it first came out, but hadn't seen it since, and was really struck by how it's a romance between Bruce Wayne and Andrea, a very complicated flashback structure of how they first met, which does have a His Girl Friday. I can see the setting a little bit, but it's less comic than that, maybe, but it definitely has this golden age vibe to it.
Yeah, definitely. It's more of a spiky, kind of prickly romance that develops rather than I think maybe more to have and have not kind of vibe than
That makes
than
sense.
A His Girl Friday. And she's a really great villain, and she's a villain that's very unexpected in her development, and she's unlike a lot of female villains where their sexuality is a very pointed weapon of theirs.
Yeah, that's true. It's really not part of the game here at all, and that is refreshing. I'm going to stick for my number four with a graphic novel adaptation. The character is Enid, played by Thora Birch from Ghost World. I think this is one of the most vivid portraits of a disaffected teen that I've seen on screen. Maybe you think of someone like the daughter in The Incredibles, but really she's a sweetie compared to this. Enid is a recent high school graduate here. She's something of a social misfit. And she's probably much more sure of what she hates about life than what she likes about it. So her default posture is to greet life with this withering sarcasm. She rolls her eyes the way other people breathe, basically. One of Enid's quotes, and there's this mashup on YouTube of all her great lines, but one of them is about how she can't relate to humanity. And the only people she has time for are her best friend, played by Scarlett Johansson, and this lonely older guy, played by Steve Buscemi, who they initially play a practical joke on, but then they come to befriend.
You are like the luckiest guy in the world. I would kill to have stuff like this.
Please, go ahead and kill me.
Oh, come on. What are you talking about?
Well, you think it's healthy to obsessively collect things? You can't connect with other people, so you fill your life with stuff? Just like all the rest of these pathetic collector losers.
No, you're not. You're a cool guy, Seymour.
I'm so cool. How come I haven't had a girlfriend in like 4 years? I can't even remember the last time a girl talked to me.
I'm talking to you. You know, I bet there are tons of women who'd go out with you in a minute. I know I could get you a date in like 2 seconds.
Good luck.
I mean it. You leave everything to me, I'm going to be your own personal dating service.
I put Enid on this list because it's much more than Birch perfectly playing a type. She does that well. But as the movie expands and deepens, it becomes this really bittersweet character study. And it ends, at least for Enid, on this tart note of loneliness and new adventure, somehow combines both of those things. I should mention the source material here is Daniel Clowes' graphic novel, also called Ghost World, and Clowes did the screenplay along with the director, Terry Zwigoff. That brings us to our number three picks. Who did you have at number three, Angelica?
For number three, I have probably one of the best comic characters to ever exist, Wonder Woman.
Okay, Wonder Woman. Here she is.
So this is Wonder Woman voiced by Kerry Russell in the animated film. And the story pulls a lot from George Perez's run that occurred during the late 80s. And what draws me to that performance is how naive Diana is at the beginning. But she's also a little bit cocky because she hasn't been to man's world before and she believes her way is the right way. And to be honest, what's funny about Wonder Woman, she usually is right.
Easy. You're lucky to be alive, so just conserve your energy and rest.
Did you stop Ares?
No, I didn't. I couldn't.
What? Why not?
I had to save you.
Ow!
I didn't need you to save me. I needed you to stop Ares.
Hey, if it weren't for me, you wouldn't be here right now.
I'm an Amazon, Steve. We're prepared from birth to give our lives in battle. I knew what the consequences were going into this mission. I bet you would have acted differently if I were a man.
Oh, playing the...
I just love her energy, and it's part coming-of-age story, part, like, woman warrior story, part, like, feminist fable. And I don't think we get that sort of mix for women. There's not a lot of coming-of-age stories for women.
This really does lean into the feminist part of this mm-hmm. character. And I happened to catch it for the first time in preparation for this show. And that was refreshing to see, but I was trying to put that alongside the visual characterization mm-hmm. of Wonder Woman. Adam and I were throwing this out there last week when we briefly discussed the Wonder Woman trailer and mm-hmm. how they are sticking with the look, right? Mm-hmm. This bustier that's mm-hmm. fairly sexualized and yet knowing that this is also a feminist character. How do those two things go together? And for me, at least in this version, the 2009 one that you're referring to, what I like about it is that she seems oblivious to her own bombshellness. Mm-hmm. When she leaves this world of women and enters the outside world, our world, she may look like a sex object, at least to the men of our world, but she doesn't carry herself like one. And more importantly, the narrative doesn't treat her mm-hmm. like one. So in my mind, that kind of reconciled it, at least in this version.
Definitely.
But is that, what was your take on sort of the costuming and the character design, really the physicality of this character? Because it's really exaggerated, you've got to admit.
It is. Well, and that's something about Diana. We're on a first name basis. That's
apparently,
why
yes.
I'm not calling her Wonder Woman.
You're very lucky.
But that's the thing about Diana. One of her gifts that she gets from the gods is her beauty. And I mean, if you're gifted with beauty from Aphrodite, you're going to be pretty hot. But she's raised in a society where sexism isn't a factor for her. So how she looks at her beauty and her body and herself is going to be very different. And how she carries herself is going to be different. And I think for filmmakers and comic writers and artists, as long as they acknowledge that dynamic and don't draw her in a way that's very male gaze oriented and more thinking about how she would look at herself, that kind of nulls any sort of weird sexism. But then sometimes, you know, creators like to have their cake and eat it too.
Sure. But I do feel what you're describing, I sense that in this variation, this
correct.
2009 one. So I did enjoy that quite a bit. All right. So my number three, we're up to our number three picks. And this is where I'm going to put someone who was inevitable for this list, I think. It's Selina Kyle, Catwoman, played by Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman Returns. I did watch Tim Burton's 1992 sequel for the first time since its release for this show. And without a doubt, Pfeiffer's the best thing in the film. I do like other elements. I think Keaton's still great as this jumpy, perplexed Bruce Wayne. Christopher Walken, he's doing vintage Walken as dastardly businessman Max Schreck. And that opening with the Penguin's baby basket floating into Gotham sewers is Burton at his visually gothic best. Mm-hmm. But then Burton turns over most of the movie to the Penguin as an adult, played by Danny DeVito. And a little of DeVito's routine goes a long way. And in the meantime, the life force of the film, Pfeiffer as Selina Kyle, doesn't get as much screen time as she deserves. Kyle here is Schreck's put-upon executive assistant. And Pfeiffer's ingenious approach to the character is not to play her mousy in those early scenes, but funny.
Okay. Go ahead. Intimidate me. Bully me if it makes you feel big. I mean, it's not like you can just kill me.
Actually, it's a lot like that. Huh? Huh?
You know, for a second there, you really frightened me.
Pfeiffer has great comic timing, and I had forgotten that. She has this self-deprecating sense of humor, these really biting asides that she'll toss off. And there's this one scene. For me, this is the key to her character. It comes early on after Batman saves her from a mugger who was threatening her with a taser. Batman leaves. The guy's lying there unconscious, and she picks up the taser and fiendishly gives him an extra shock. That's all we need to believe that she really could become the violent, vindictive Catwoman, which happens after Schreck pushes her out of a window and a pack of alley cats lick her back to life. From that point on, Pfeiffer lets the hint of crazy we saw in Selena come roaring out, and she just devours the rest of the movie. It's not only in her over-the-top come-on scenes, though. The film maybe overplays those a little bit. But it's also in the way she hints that this split personality she's experiencing is both freeing and a painful experience.
You killed me. The Penguin killed me. Batman killed me. That's three lives down. You got enough in there to finish me off?
One way to find out.
Four. Five. Still alive!
So Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman, my number three.
That's funny. She's my number two.
Nice.
I've always really, really loved Michelle Pfeiffer, and I've always loved her performance as Selina Kyle, who is one of my favorite comic book characters. Even though I'm not a big fan of Batman Returns, I also recently rewatched it for the first time in a very long time, and I cannot stand the movie itself. A lot of times it just kept pissing me off, but she is just such a flash of energy.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's intended by the filmmakers, but she's actually a really interesting take on what it means to be a modern woman and live in a world with sexism and live in a world where your power is curtailed by men.
There's a lot of that in those early scenes with her in the office building. Yeah, as a working woman, for sure.
And as she becomes Catwoman and really embraces that side of herself and being sexual, and it becomes an interesting fable about the safety that women lose when they actually give in to their own desires in a very interesting way. And I don't think it's even intended, but rewatching the film as an adult, like, I really connected with her character and fell in love with her. And she's just hilarious, and her physicality is just like, I want to move like Catwoman. She's hot.
It's pretty amazing, like, when she's doing, and maybe there was some stunt work involved because there are some pretty crazy flips and stuff. But even when she's moving through the department store with the security guards, it's not just being alluring, it's balletic.
Yes.
And I noticed that too this time. Yeah, very
impressive. A lot of grace to her. Yes. And it's an interesting contrast from how we see her in the beginning.
Absolutely.
And it's what's fascinating to me is, like, the beginning of her as just regular old Selina Kyle, who's very self-deprecating and kind of over the life she's living. I feel like that's a fantasy that every woman wants, to become Catwoman and kind of embrace their, like, badass side and not give a damn about the consequences.
And the movie certainly lets her do that. So
yes, it does.
Nice. I'm glad we had one in common. So at number two for me is Marjan, voiced by Chiara Mastroianni. And this is from the film Persepolis. Now, the term character here applies in a slightly different way, I think. Persepolis is an adaptation of Marjan Satrapi's graphic novel about a young Iranian woman coming of age in the 1970s and 80s. So it's based very much on her own experiences and, you know, is something of an autobiography. Satrapi shared screenwriting and directing credit with Vincent Perrineau, and the movie retains the graphic novel's stark black and white imagery. It's very faithful in that way. In terms of Marjan as a character, I like how the vocal work done by Mastroianni here and the visuals are asked to do two different things. So Marjan sounds very aloof, and she can even be snarky, especially as she gains more confidence and becomes a teen, but the use of shadows and light are revealing this bruised and fractured psyche at the same time. So watching those two elements work in concert is pretty exciting. This pick does make me feel a little bit ashamed, though, because it reminds me that Satrapi has made three other films as a director since Persepolis: Chicken with Plums, The Gang of the Jotas, and The Voices. And I've yet to see any of them, admitting that here, though. To be fair to myself, here's the plot description for The Voices. I don't know if you know this. A likable guy, played by Ryan Reynolds, pursues his office crush with the help of his evil talking pets. But things turn sinister when she stands him up for a date. You have seen this?
Oh, my God. So I started watching that, and I'm someone who's very, very sensitive to portrayals of mental illness in film. Like, I don't.
Okay.
There's a certain fidelity that I expect.
This didn't have it.
And it didn't have it. And it just really upset me because I feel that pop culture does affect the way these issues are stigmatized.
Sure.
And it just got on my nerves. And I was like, also, I was like, wait a minute, I'm not drunk enough to actually watch Ryan Reynolds.
Okay. There's a limit, huh?
Yeah.
That's good to know. But might be a while then till I catch up with that one. So let's say for now, Persepolis, absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Undeniably unique in the world of graphic novel adaptations. Mm-hmm. So Marjan is my number two.
Nice.
We are down to our number one picks. Who is your number one woman comic book character done right?
So my number one is, because she's fresh on my mind, and I did love, love, love the performance, Viola Davis as Amanda the Wall Waller from Suicide Squad.
Jumping right up to number one. Like,
she is
an hour out of the screening.
I know.
She's already, wow, that is something.
But she's very different than the kind of comic characters we see adapted as a woman. She doesn't have superpowers. She's not young. She's not even trying to be a sex pot. She has natural hair, which is so nice to see a black woman with natural hair. And she's a true anti-hero. You know what? If she went into a room with Walter White, he'd be dead in like 5 seconds. I would not mess with her. She,
having seen the movie, I believe you.
She is just so fascinating. Her psychology, she just feels like a really lived-in character. And part of it is because she stands out against everything else that's not really working in the movie. But man, Viola Davis can really bring a whole world with her. Like, you can feel, it doesn't really get into her backstory or anything, but you can tell this is a woman who's fought for her place at the table.
So I'll give you this, and you know, we spend time praising it in our review of Suicide Squad. That's the one character I'm most interested in following in a subsequent film.
Me too.
And you wouldn't expect that in a movie that has all of these, maybe not bigger, well, more popular names.
Oh, definitely.
In it, and more outlandish characters, yeah. Let's just say. But she's the one I'm curious about. She's the one that transfixed me the most. Mm-hmm. And so if there's any appeal to me for another Suicide Squad film, it's in one that follows her story a little bit more. So
I agree.
I can see that as jumping up to number one. Not who I have, though. I have Lois Lane, played by Margot Kidder from Superman. Oh. I know you're not high on those movies.
But I do love her. She's
good.
Like my favorite Lois.
All right. I think she's great. I mean, this is how you do a damsel in distress. If you have to do it.
If you have to do it.
You shouldn't have to do it. But here, if you're going to do it, go the Margot Kidder route. She wins for the way she handles, especially that first rescue scene in Superman.
Oh, that is lovely.
She's not breathily grateful, you know?
Yeah.
She's not in a fit of hysterics, as you might expect. Instead, when Superman catches her falling from a helicopter, she responds with a wisecrack.
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me? Who's got you?
It strikes me that women characters in comic book movies were allowed to fight before they were allowed to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is probably because fighting can still be considered and depicted as sexy.
Okay? Oh, definitely.
It's harder for a filmmaker to do that with funny.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that's why things turned out that way. And in a sense then, Kidder's Lois Lane was blazing a trail here. She's leading both with her intelligence and her ability to make us laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I also like that even when she starts to swoon for Superman, which is also very funny, I like how she handles those scenes, you still see the reporter in her. So there's really a strong echo. You mentioned His Girl Friday earlier. I think there's an echo of Rosalind Russell's performance in Margot Kidder's here. So I appreciated that.
Well, let's start with your vital statistics. Are you married?
No, I'm not.
Do you have a girlfriend?
No, I don't. But if I did, Miss Lane, you'd be the first to know about it.
How old are you?
Over 21.
Oh, I get it. You don't want anyone to know how old. Okay. And how big are you? How tall are you?
About 6'4".
Superman, yeah. He's not one of my favorite superhero characters, and not all of his movies have worked for me either. The franchise, though, it's going to get this number one spot for the greatness of Margot Kidder.
That's a good reason to give it number one. She's probably the best film version of Lois Lane, who is a character I love. I love you, Lois. So wonderful.
So I know you had said going in that the list proved sort of difficult to make. It was challenging, even with expanding it to graphic novel adaptations. Does that mean you don't really have many honorable mentions here?
I don't have any honorable mentions. It was very hard to come up with a list. And I think it's because I have certain expectations as a reader of these characters beforehand. Plus, I feel like a lot of these female characters get flattened or they get kind of put into the sidelines. And the reason why they work is usually because an actress brings so much to the role that isn't on the page, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, allow me, the non-expert, to add a few here. Rosario Dawson's Gale stands out in Sin City. I'm going to argue. No?
I actually love her performance, but I hate Frank. I was going to put her on my list.
Okay.
But I think my hate for Frank Miller is so strong and long running. And I just hate how the character's written, but I love her. And okay. She has great energy. So it's like this conflict with like...
Yeah, well, you know. It was her. You could have put her on the list. Yeah. She could have been an honorable mention for you. How about Adele, played by Adele Exarchopoulos in Blue is the Warmest Color? Now, I had some issues with the various gazes going on in that movie, so I'm a little hesitant, but I think the performance, Exarchopoulos, is doing some amazing stuff. Now, covering similar territory with a bit more consistency for me is Diary of a Teenage Girl, adapted by Mariel Heller. From Phoebe Gleckner's graphic novel. I think Diary, starring Belle Powley, that has more cohesion between the main character of the film and the camera's point of view than Blue is the Warmest Color. I actually also like Anne Hathaway's Catwoman in The Dark Knight Returns. She's no Michelle Pfeiffer. So,
no, she
you know,
isn't.
But I enjoyed her spin on it.
I actually did too.
Good. And then Marvel-wise, I would just reference both Gwyneth Paltrow's Pepper Potts and Hayley Atwell's Peggy Carter. They're among the more compelling female characters in that universe.
That's true.
So those are our top five women comic book characters done right. Who did we overlook? We'd love to hear your picks. Send them along to feedback@filmspotting.net. That brings us to new releases in theaters this weekend. Opening in limited release is Gleason, a documentary about an NFL player who developed ALS in his 30s, and Indignation. This is based on the novel by Philip Roth. Opening wide is Nine Lives. A businessman finds himself trapped inside the body of his family cat. Sam, our co-producer here, buried the lead in providing me these notes. The businessman is played by Kevin Spacey, so just think about that. Also opening wide release, the film that we reviewed, Suicide Squad. Next week, I'm off, but Adam returns with a guest host who's yet to be determined, as is just about everything else for this show. Pete's Dragon, Sausage Party, Hell or High Water. Adam's going to be going in one of those directions with someone. If you have a comment about this show, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail at 312-264-0744, and you may hear it featured on an upcoming show. You can find Film Spotting on Facebook and on Twitter, at Film Spotting. That's Adam. I'm at Larson on Film. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week is by The Julie Ruin, comes from the new album Hit Reset. More information is at thejulieruin.com. Angelica, thanks again for putting in the double duty night, seeing the screening, coming right to the studio, doing the review. I really appreciate it, and I really encourage listeners to catch up with your work if they're not familiar with it already. What's the best way for them to do that?
There's two really good ways to follow my work. One is on Twitter, and my handle is at Angelica Bastien, and that's AngelicaBastien. Or you can check out my website, which is madwomenandmuses.com.
Thanks again. This was a lot of fun. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.